No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, a grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined tonight by a very special guest, Tia Bell, and we hope that our conversation will start you thinking about solutions to some of the problems we face in our community. If you have a question for Tia, you can call in at 888-627-6008. Tia Bell, thanks so much for being on the show tonight. And welcome.
Thank you, Senator Brown, for having me. I'm very grateful to be on this platform with you, and I'm hoping to educate and spread some prevention tonight.
Yeah, me too. And let me just start. I'm going to ask you to talk about your experience in a minute, but let me just let our audience know that Tia received a Bachelor of Science in Sports Management from North Carolina State University in 2011. She was an outstanding basketball player, but following multiple acute knee injuries, her basketball career ended. She was the first person in her family to complete high school, college, and pursue a master's degree. That's an amazing accomplishment. And after all that, she decided to give back and is the founder of Four LLC and the Trigger Project. And that's what we want to talk about tonight. Tia, tell us about the Trigger Project and how you came about this and what you're trying to accomplish.
Absolutely. Founding the Trigger Project in 2019 was really a dynamic shift in my life, but also for the lives of the many young people that I've served prior to our founding and all the way up until now. Trigger and Trigger Project stands for True Reasons I Grabbed the Gun, Evolved from Risk. And we are a nonprofit based in my hometown, Washington, D.C., aiming to prevent future gun violence through the intersectionality of positive youth development and public health.
Well, and before we go any further, I've got to say this because my wife would yell at me if I don't, but I see that you're a student at Deal Middle School, and my wife was the librarian there for a while. Yeah.
Hey, Deal changed my life. Librarians changed my life. How about that? But I'm gonna refer to those as protective factors later. But I just have to say this really quick. I got a chance to go back to my alma mater, Deal. I actually didn't graduate from there, and I'll get into that later. But I learned the most. I was educated the most in my life at Deal, and going back there this past year for National Youth Violence Prevention Week was certainly a full circle, and I look forward to continuing the partnership with Principal Neil and the Vikings over there.
Well, that's great. And I would go back to my middle school, but I'm not sure it's still there. You know, it was so long since I went. Anyway, that's great. And I had to mention that. And Deal is a really great school. But what motivated you to start Trigger? I think that your experience is very, very important. To how this all developed. Tell us about it.
Yeah. Well, my lived experience is what really validates my expertise as a youth advocate and a gun violence prevention expert. And I started Trigger Project vulnerably out of anger. As you mentioned earlier, I founded 4LLC, which was in honor of my uncle, who died from gun violence disease in 2007. And at the time, I was only 17. I was Gatorade Player of the Year, second time around. I was All-Met, All-American. And I just had so much reverence, you know, in my life. I was put on a pedestal my entire life and just protected in every form and fashion. And so fast forward, I got hurt in college. And I had some unimaginable experiences there. One notable one is at my college coach's funeral, she passed away from breast cancer, and it was devastating to us. But as a sophomore, I think I was just 19 years old, I had seen more death and demise and trauma than all of my teammates. And so they were crying at her funeral, and I was at peace. And so that was a transformational awakening for me. And then fast forward, I'm playing basketball. I'm really good at NC State. I'm looking at, I'm in the race for sixth man of the year. I just dropped into the top 10 for records of block shots and had 9 block shots in the game. And I was just soaring, you know, and that all came to an end after a devastating knee injury, which led to 3 other reconstructive surgeries all on the same leg. And so I had to put the number 4 on my chest that honored my uncle into motion as an organization. And so I moved home in 2016 after getting my master's. And all of this is relevant because I had been going to schools after, you know, there was teen violence. There was youth violence in 2016. I remember a very notable rapper being killed the month I moved home. I remember picking up a young person to go to an event with him, and his friend got killed right after we left. So we couldn't even go to the event. We had to turn back around. And so youth violence was occurring. And when I would approach city leaders and schools to partner, they didn't understand how youth development played a role in violence prevention. And so for LLC's mission was to disrupt gun violence through youth development. Well, in 2019, I was at the Centers for American Progress annual gun violence prevention conference. And so Greg Jackson, who's now the deputy director over at the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, which is historical in this movement for us. But he called me back in 2019 and said, hey, Tia, there's a panel on community-based solutions. I want you to come and talk about the work that FOR is doing. You're on to something. You know, come represent D.C. And so I took a 20-minute ride across town. We were at a church. I can't remember the church, but we were on 16th Street Northwest. Which I was born and raised in Northwest. My mother was a gun violence victim in Northwest, but I had not spent a lot of time in that area. And so I'm already uncomfortable, but I get to this meeting, and I'm the only one, Senator Brown, who sounds like me, looks like me, who's fighting for what they called in the room community violence. I felt that name wasn't fair. I felt that community, if it was equipped with enough resources and safe spaces, that we wouldn't have violence, you know. And so I knew that there was a thin line between victims and shooters. And at this meeting, there was such an emphasis on mass shooters and suicide. There was no real voice for interpersonal and community violence. And so, I'm sorry, the interpersonal violence that disproportionately affects community. I don't want to call it community violence. So out of anger, I'm like, they don't understand the shooter. They don't understand, you know, my mom could have been on either side. My friends could have been on either side. I've had loved ones on both sides. We're never going to get anywhere if we don't include, you know, the shooter in this conversation. And so after that day, I had a dream. And I also went back to my young people and told them, hey, like, you know, you all's voice is absent in on this national stage. And so I was angry that I had to speak for them. I was angry that my story was nowhere near in comparison of what my youth faced every day. And, you know, people felt, you know, sorry for me in that room. It felt like I was the expert, and it just felt like we were underrepresented. And so Trigger started, again, out of frustration, out of a need for there to be compassion and a comprehensive understanding of this disease. And, you know, at the same time in 2019, our city was moving in a direction of violence interruption. We had deemed gun violence a public health issue in 2017. And so it was all feeling like youth who were like me, who were exposed to this disease, but who didn't have the desire to pick up the gun. It felt like we were ignored. And so I came up with True Reasons I Grabbed the Gun evolve from risk. And I didn't do it alone. It was with a team. I'm very collaborative. As you mentioned, I played at NC State, H.D. Woodson. I've always been in a leadership captain position. I'm the oldest of five. And so I've been a team player my whole life, Senator Brown. And it felt only right to include everyone at the table, not just putting us on the menu, not using us as a political agenda or football or talent show. You know, I was just sick of the political violence back then and thought we needed a movement. And so today, 4 years later, and four is a magic number, you know that now.
Yeah.
We have thousands of youth who've pledged to prevention, and we view prevention very clearly. It also aligns with the Association of Public Health, America's Public Health Association, but prevention defined at the Trigger Project is the absence and proactive state of gun violence. Prevention is the absence and proactive state of gun violence. Senator Brown, you are prevention. Your wife is prevention. I am prevention. You now serve as protective factors, potentially, which lessens the likelihood of developing the disease of gun violence. And so that this tragedy had to be placed, had to be centered in a youth setting as well as in a true public health setting, a true setting which looked at the science, the art of protecting people as a whole.
Well, let me first say that you're so right about this, Tia, because I've spent a long time in my life training political candidates. And one of the first things we say to them, I've trained Native Americans that want to run for public office. And we've been pretty successful. We've gotten a bunch of them elected. But the first thing we say to them is, if you don't have a seat at the table, you don't get heard. And in fact, if you don't have a seat at the table, very often you find yourself on the menu. So you need to be there. You need to have a presence, and you're absolutely right. And you know, I think that all of us think we know more than the people that have the absolute experience, and that's wrong. But let me ask you, you say that you have to understand the shooter. I've seen this on your website. Explain this to us. Understand his motivation or her motivation to grab a gun?
So understanding that the shooter manifests out of oppression, out of their conditions, out of their circumstances. We're doing research under a partnership right now with the University of Michigan. They have a youth violence prevention center. It's one of four youth violence prevention centers in the country. And they're working diligently with us to document our work, track our work so that we can scale it, you know, evaluate it and scale it. And we ask all of our partners, why is the trigger pulled? And what the research, which my lived experience already knows, but what the research is starting to validate is that youth and key stakeholders, key partners, I don't like using the word stakeholders, but key partners, are blaming the individual. So they're blaming the beef, they're blaming the behavior, and only. And what that does is it only really allows us to help or solve or support or fix this problem or heal this problem through a public safety lens when you look only at the individual behavior. But gun violence is a psychosocial, emotional, behavioral, physiological, environmental, economical disease. And so we are not only looking at the individual, we're looking at the community, we're looking at the society, we're looking at culture, we're looking at politics, we're looking at all the realms that impact the development of these individuals. So understand the shooter is the beginning of a sentence. Understand the shooter evolved from conditions, circumstances, and root causes, you know, root causes like poverty, like this poor housing crisis we're facing in our country and in our city specifically. Of course, we have root causes of the lack of economic opportunity, you know, and so by us being on the menu for so long, our voice isn't included in the plan. So understand that the shooter is ignored and the potential shooter is ignored. And all of us have a trigger finger, so all of us are potentially at risk of picking up a gun, especially with the access to them in our city. So we just, again, we're aiming to destigmatize this condition, this disease. We want people to view the shooter or the potential shooter as infected or exposed or unwell, versus just the issue, the problem, the menace, you know. And it's just, it's that compassion. It's that my great-grandmother, my mom had me as a teen and then was exposed to all of her adversities and trauma. And so a lot of my time spent growing up was with my great-grandmother, and she welcomed everyone in the house. It came with a curse out, but it came with love as well, and it was unconditional support. And that's not what I see. I see blame, and I'm not just seeing this. I'm witnessing this. I'm experiencing this through this lack of understanding through our youth demise. Senator Brown, I think you know this, but the first homicide in our city was a young man, one of my young men. Who had a great mom, who had a great family, you know? So why isn't our city enraged? Why aren't we trying a new lens? Insanity is trying the same thing over, expecting different results. Why aren't we understanding the shooter?
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right about that. You know, that they, if people are not vested in the system, if, you know, because of poverty. I mean, they just released census tract data on violence in gun violence in the District of Columbia, violent crimes in general. And of course, the highest tracts were in Anacostia. The highest increases were in Anacostia. And I don't know how you can look at something like that and think it's coincidental somehow. You know, it's obviously not, you know.
People that are not
vested in the system, tend to act out. And we've seen it. We've just even seen it in a horrible, horrible way in the Middle East, right?
Exactly.
You know, the Palestinians feel abused, and they've lashed out in just such a horrible way, and now, although, you know, I think most people's sympathies are with the Israelis, now they're going to go into Gaza, and do horrendous things in retaliation. So there are no winners. I think that's
exactly
something that people don't understand. There's no way to win with a gun. If you pull a gun out and shoot somebody, you not only destroy their lives, but you destroy your life too.
Exactly.
And I'm sorry about your one of your people and the fact that you lost somebody. And I think that too often we also ignore the victim. We also ignore that the impact this has on the community by taking out young, brilliant, you know, people who are engaged. I remember a horrible crime. I don't know if you remember this. You might be too young, but it happened. I lived on Pennsylvania Avenue in Southeast, and there's a McDonald's there on Pennsylvania Avenue right before the bridge. You probably know where it is. But
yeah,
some
I'm familiar right there.
Yeah. Some kid came in at night and killed everybody in the McDonald's. He was an employee at the McDonald's, and he shot everybody in the McDonald's except for one woman who was able to lock herself in the freezer. But the next day, when they reported on the people that had been killed, the really heartbreaking thing was the manager was a mom putting her kid to her first child through college. Nobody in her family had ever gone to college, and she was managing. She was doing this. She had gone to college, but none of her children had gone to college. She was managing the place so that she could put her kid through college. The other kids that were working there, one was an honor student at Anacostia High School. One was, the list just went on and on and on. And that's the thing that resonated with me, was not only did, you know, obviously they caught the kid right away because he was an employee and a woman that locked herself in the freezer knew who he was. But not only that his life was destroyed, but that he had destroyed so many positive lives in the balance. And we just don't have enough good people to waste. You know, we can't afford to waste any of them, can we? So let me ask you, you talk about prevention strategies.
Yes,
what give us some prevention strategies.
Absolutely. If you don't mind, I just wanted to start. You reminded me of a really famous quote that one of my mentors, speaking of prevention, mentorship is a pillar of prevention.
Yes,
but
it is.
One of my mentors says this quote all the time. He says two quotes. One of them is that an African proverb. He says, the youth will burn its village down to feel its warmth.
Yes.
Youth will burn its village down to fill its warmth. And so, you know, we sort of have conditioned ourselves to validate war, you know, and not really think about the reasoning, or you know, but just as the action itself, we validate that. But it's hard to sort of understand the duality of when that happens in the community. And so mm-hmm. you definitely touched on that. And it is really important to tell stories. I think when we first started Trigger, we wanted it to be a movie because we wanted to show how gun violence spreads in a creative way. And we knew that if our youth could work on this project creatively, it could combat their brain and the trauma that stunts their brain and develop their hippocampus and help them with problem solving and making decisions. And so we actually couldn't get the support or funding to start that movie. But you're right, the stories of the victims, their families, the survivors, the witnesses are so important. You also made me think about ownership. If any young person dies in this city, because I call myself a youth advocate, a community mother, because I am the mother of two children who are impacted by the lack of safety in this city, you know, I take ownership of all youth. And I think if people listening could do that, could find the value in empathy, you know, we could be somewhere else too. But let's get to prevention. I just really wanted to note those things because you said a lot, sir.
well, and this is very important. And I had a mom. So, God bless you, because that was my mom. My mom worked in an inner city school, and that was her job. That's what she saw as her first job, was being a mom. So if any kid had any problem, she'd just walk up to him, you know, like she had a badge or something and say, hi, I'm a mom. What can I do to help you? And we all take, because, you know, as Hillary Clinton said, I mean, it's kind of a cliche now, but it does take a village to raise a child.
It takes a village. Or if not, the village will be burned to feel its warmth. And so we like to say at Trigger, Gundistand. We've patented that term. It's a verb. It's about action. But it's understanding the root causes and risk factors that lead to the gun violence disease. So, of course, I mentioned if you have a history of family conflict, or if you have a learning difference or disability, if you don't have a place or space to belong, if you don't have a faith. Faith is a protective factor. The lack of faith is a risk factor. These things are on the CDC's website that lead to the likelihood of developing youth violence, falling victim or being a perpetrator. It's both where these risk factors lie. Now, protective factors, probably one of the most common protective factors that there are is safe storage, gun safety. A lot of the political journey in preventing gun violence falls around gun safety. So it is, in fact, a protective factor, and it is a pillar of prevention. It's just not the only form. I'm going to go through a list, and I hope you guys can catch up. I just want
to please.
So here we go. Having a high GPA in school, having high aspirations, popularity or being well-known, feeling safe often, community participation and protection, involvement in positive activity, supervision at home. We have a partnership with OST Coalition, the Out of School Time Coalition. And we're trying, they're getting behind us with placing gun violence prevention in the out of school time, you know, realm, because supervision alone is a protective factor. involved in positive activity, a lot of having the ability to plan ahead, having the ability to focus or be creative, faith, strong social skills, sobriety, strong connection to family or strong connection to healthy adult relationship, coordinated support from community, self-awareness, connection to resources, and safe schools. These are all protective factors.
Well, since you brought this up, why don't you tell people listening to how they can connect, as long as we're on the subject, with Trigger. Give them your website.
Absolutely. Long but simple. It's thetriggerproject.org online. You can find us. You can learn a lot more about our philosophy, which, again, it doesn't start at Trigger Project. We just are amplifying what the CDC and the APHA have already had out there for decades. We just are learning, again, through our youth demise, that public health crises of gun violence is lip service and not really of action or people-driven. And so look us up online, also at thetriggerproject.org. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, at thetriggerprojectdc, and on Twitter, at thetriggerproj. We couldn't go that long.
Well, let me also say that you know, we have a terrible... You brought up a couple of things that I want to just touch on real quick. One is gun safety. We have a terrible problem in the District of Columbia with guns coming into the city and getting into the wrong hands. You know, you have children. I raised a 14-year-old boy. My 14-year-old son has now graduated from college and is a responsible citizen and a manager of a great business. And I wouldn't have wanted him to have a gun at 14. You know, 14-year-old boy, especially 14-year-old boys, and unfortunately now we see it with girls too, but, you know, I think about the incident. We had a very, very unusual thing happen here in the District of Columbia on 8th Street. Brian Robinson, who you probably know, is a running back. Not only a running back, he's a really good running back for the Commanders. Shot by a 15-year-old boy. Now, first of all, let me just say, this is a big, strong man. At 15 years old, I would have been so intimidated by some guy. He's like 6'2", 230 or something like that. He's a really big guy. But anyway, the 15-year-old wasn't intimidated. But after the fact, after they caught him, he said all he wanted was a car. He wanted a car, and that's all he could think of. And he realized that he wasn't thinking. Well, that's the problem with kids that age, is they can't see past the end of their nose. They can't see beyond what they want in the immediate, and they can't see the consequences of what they're doing. So, I mean, I don't know what we do about keeping guns out of kids' hands other than trying to keep them safe. And I think we all have a responsibility for that. And, you know, I grew up around guns. And if you own a gun and you're not keeping it safe, I think you should be responsible for it. I think I really do. You know, we also have another problem. And I don't know how much of this you think impacts our youth in D.C., but Colbert King wrote yesterday in the paper that our criminal justice system structure is a plague on local governance and accountability. We have a really screwed up system here. You know, how does that affect, like, the pipeline to prison for kids? And I mean, what can we do with our justice system here to make things better for kids? That's a big question. I understand.
It was so loaded, but I'm going to break it down. First and foremost, you mentioned the need of the individual. And I felt so connected to that instance because the young man's name was Brian, you know, and played for the Commanders. And I was a student athlete. I was not a professional athlete, but I feel like I played almost at the highest level in the ACC.
Yeah.
And when I lived home in D.C. in the early 2000s and during the 90s, student athletes, musicians, go-go band leaders, voices, bandmates, we were all protected. We were revered. We were the stars. We were the celebrities. We were the hope. And so fast forward now, I'm, you know, 34, a resident of D.C., and I just see literally all those groups I just named being the most impacted. And it is heart-wrenching for me to know that some of these instances are behind the actions of young people. First and foremost, I'm a youth development master's. A lot of people think my master's is in public health, which is very flattering, but no, I studied youth development, and we view youth from the ages of 0 to 26 or 0 to 28 if you are male. And of course, trauma stunts the brain. So emotionally, logically, you may be stopped at the time of a traumatic event and stunted, and you may react, of course, from that age of trauma versus your actual age. Also, the youth brain is most malleable between 0 and 5 and during teenage years. And the thing that's developing is identity, social awareness for teenagers, and through relationship and interaction with people, they're developing their identity. So if they're walking down the street every day and people are fearing them all the time, then they become that. I know music is something we tend to stay away from and not to blame, but if you listen to the cycles of music that you hear and your brain is not, you know, fully functioning or healthy enough to decipher and make the distinction of what's real and what's music, then your brain is going to develop those patterns that are in the music. The young people that are behind these guns, I share the responsibility with them as an adult growing up in this city. I don't take the responsibility from them at all. I just don't believe it makes sense to hold them accountable. I know the next stage where most people point the fingers are the parents. I'm actually working with partners to bring a new light to healing and development for parents. But it's hard to really blame that individual, too, when gun violence spreads through model behavior. It is a learned behavior with how this spreads. And so that young man saw that someone handled their problem or handled getting a need with a gun. And so he, in turn, did that as well. And so I want there to just be that context for people. And I think Brian Robinson was admirable in his response. I've had partners be in contact with the commanders, and are getting support from commanders directly, and they say it all the time, like, he's a hero. And I actually had a chance to speak at Tulane School of Public Health with social workers all across the nation, and I met one of his social workers in high school who talked about him just being this hero, you know, just hero, leader, role model, guy from the beginning. And so I'm sorry, and it's devastating for him to go through that, but I am grateful that it did happen to someone like that who could help, you know, people understand the remorse and the compassion that's needed to really get to the youth, because now it is spreading deep and wide to our young people. So back to the need, that car was seen as a need, as a resource. We've read, we've known, we've heard that young people are sleeping in cars. My mother, who is the reason I started this journey, she was shot twice in broad daylight when I was just 10 years old. And she believed someone slept in her car to get a safe, good night's rest, because we found a book bag randomly in the back seat, and we don't know where it came from. So we placed it on our porch. We didn't call the police. We didn't, you know, we placed it on our porch hoping someone would get it. No one ever came to get it. But we know almost for certain that someone came to sleep in her car. So the need has to be considered, you know. The young people feel like they need a gun. In our city, we talk about the bureaucracy and just the chaos among agencies right now and branches of government. Right. You know, there's no collaboration. And quite frankly, we see city leaders beefing in public. You know, it might be more tolerable because they're using words, but they're not showing collaboration. So how could they expect a neighborhood that has not seen eye to eye with another neighborhood down the street to, you know, come together. You know, so I think first modeling behavior all the way from our city leaders, all the way down to our moms who are carrying babies right now is so important. And again, the responsibility trigger, we do not believe that shooters should not be held accountable. We just believe that the cage, that jail is not the only way. Being criminalized is not the only way. And right now you see youth who are truant being criminalized. They come in contact with DYRS, a grant from DYRS or a grant from Victim Services comes to their school because there's high truancy. So now they're being criminalized and they're being late, maybe because they got to take all their brothers and sisters to school first. Not because they got the gun or they're abusing substances, but because of a need, you know? And then these grant programs can't provide the need. They could just count the amount of people they come in contact with. But where are the resources, where are the referrals really leading to? It's not leading them out of the problem. You know, so I'm very disappointed in our government's approach and lack of collaboration. So frustrated that we created the annual End Gun Violence Citywide Conference Festival that we do in June for Gun Violence Awareness Month. And we try to include every level of the youth ecological system, from families to dentists to small business owners to faith-based leaders to policymakers, of course, down to you, because all these levels and systems that I just named, even media is invited to participate in a prevention planning and collaborative day. But, you know, all these systems, if not working together, fail the development of our youth. The first skill in life we learn is trust. If young people don't learn trust from getting their needs met, from being fed, from being changed, from going to sleep, getting rest, filling skin, then they develop mistrust. Then you develop lack of hope. Then you develop lack of autonomy. Then you develop lack of conflict resolution. Then, you know, it is not senseless violence. It makes real sense. And if we can only start at holding a young person accountable, we are tripping. We are lunching. We are not going to go anywhere if that's where we start. Because again, if you place a young person in a real youth realm has just been coming to my mind a lot. I don't know. But space, you think of the hierarchy of needs. And if someone doesn't have a safe space, water, food, shelter, support, they can't reach transcendence. They can't reach actualization, which is required to be responsible and accountable. So it is a disaster. I really truly believe our city doesn't know how to use my expertise. We have a real just an experience in this epidemic of youth violence, because we've always experienced the epidemic of gun violence since I went back to 1968 when data started, and all the way to when I was born in 1989. We were the murder capital at that point for 7 years. There were 434 homicides when I was born. I was born exposed to the disease at Howard University. You know, so if all of us looked at it that way, I really believe we would see a difference. We would see a change. We would see the prevention of this disease from spreading. And many programs citywide provide direct service or, you know, the violence interruption. But unfortunately, a shooting has to happen. Like you said, a body has to drop for for them to be able to stop retaliation, for police to be able to activate investigation. But what about before? What about before the harm?
Well, you know,
what about the siblings? You know, the classmates.
Yeah, absolutely.
Schools are left on their own too. Speaking of agencies and the working in silos and everyone just being so busy and short staffed. You know, we're not pro police, but we know it for anything to be effective, you need to have a full team. You know,
well, right.
And we're also pro collaboration. But schools are the number one substitutes are running DC public schools.
I know.
No one can call us back, but they can call us after a student is lost. But when we're trying to get in before, you can't. When we call the Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement and try to get support before, they ask, has the young person been shot yet? No, we're trying to prevent that. Yes. So help us with his birthday party and not his vigil.
Right.
But unfortunately, it's not structured for prevention.
Well, and you know what? I'm going to use a sports analogy here because I remember an interview with a guy that I very much admired, a football player that played for the Redskins. His name was Charles Mann, and he was also a sports commentator. And some guy said to him one time, well, you know, the Redskins, like, they have a bad defensive line, but they've got good linebackers. And Mann said, well, if you have to rely on your linebackers to stop the guy, you're going to lose the game. You got to stop him before he gets to the linebackers. And I think it's the same thing you're talking about. Once the guy has shot somebody, or once the person has been shot, it's kind of late to intervene. I also have to comment on rap music. You know, my kids listened to it growing up, and all of a sudden I sounded like my mother. My mother was somebody who grew up on Cole Porter and, you know, the Gershwin Boys, and she used to listen to the Rolling Stones. Right. And as she played the Rolling Stones, and I'd play the Rolling Stones, she said, I can't believe that you think that junk is music. And that's what I used to say to them about the rap. I'm like, what? What are they talking about? You know,
because exactly.
I grew up in the 60s and we talked about peace and love. And let me just make one more last comment. And this is the reason that your comment in the Washington Post intrigued me and I wanted to have you on the show, is that I grew up, as I told you, in a bad neighborhood. I was orphaned at the age of 15, had to drop out of high school. Well, didn't necessarily had to drop out of high school, but I missed 128 days of my junior year. So my high school was anxious to get rid of me. And it was because I had a sister, an older sister, who was in law school and wouldn't give up on me, that I got a general equivalency diploma, worked my way through a community college, a four-year university, and graduate school. So the support is so important. I talk to kids that drop out of high school all the time, and I say to them, you know, and I say to the people that try to find out solutions, I say, look, nobody's ever dropped out of high school because they couldn't do the work. I've never met a kid who dropped out of high school because he wasn't smart enough to do the work.
Exactly.
There's always something else going on. It's always about wraparound services. And since we're talking about the government and their lack of response, I have a question I really want to ask you. The mayor instituted a curfew in September, okay? And one of they tried to pick zones around the city where they saw a lot of youth violence. And one of those areas was in the Navy Yard. Well, we just had a congressman from Texas, a Democrat, carjacked in the Navy Yard. So
exactly.
I don't know how old the kids, you know, they haven't caught the guys, I don't think. But so it's a curfew. Is that anything, or is that just a lame kind of knee jerk thing to make people happy?
So out of respect in regards to our new chief, I do believe it is an effort to combat youth crime.
Yeah.
I believe those areas were targeted. I believe if you're going to put police there, you should also put community there, partnership there. You know, it has to be holistic and comprehensive and deep. Can't just be shallow. And I truly believe that the deputy mayor believes she's not introducing youth to the criminal justice system, when in fact, the touch point that they keep emphasizing, that, you know, youth don't actually go into YSC, which is the Youth Services Center under the Department of Youth Rehabilitative Services. So they don't actually go into the jail, but they go there, they get resources, and their parents have to pick them up. And so I just think that is, again, criminalizing and traumatizing. And one of our youth who we do this activity the first day of programming where they have to grab a cup color that associates with their exposure to the disease of gun violence. So if they have an orange cup, it's high. They have direct exposure, like myself. My mother was a victim. If it's green, they just are around it. don't really feel a connection. And if it's yellow or purple, then they feel an indirect exposure to it. And so this gentleman had a green cup and all summer was like one of our greatest leaders, the funniest one, had the most respect. And on the first night of curfew, he was picked up. And I found this out through his peers because, of course, at Trigger University, which is our programming model, which is what we want to scale. We want young people going to Trigger University and not YSC or not Child Family Services or, right. You know, we want them coming somewhere safe as a part of that hierarchy of need. But he was picked up, and two things sort of were concerning to me. First was that MPD reported no one was picked up on the first night. They reported four youth picked up over the weekend, but he was picked up on the first night. And then this, so that was concerning because I knew that if he was that young man that carjacked Brian Robertson or the congressman, it would have made CNN, you know, like first night curfew, we got a reoffender or something like that. I don't know. But it didn't make any news because, again, youth who have no desire to use a gun, who still need the support not to pick up a gun, they're invisible in this city.
Yes.
And there's a book, there's a quote out of Tony Lewis's book, Tony Lewis Jr. book, Slug. It says he saw his friends go from invisible to invincible when they picked up a gun.
Yes. That's the thing. Excuse me, is that it gives you a false sense of empowerment.
Exactly.
These kids false sense of empowerment because they don't understand the consequences of using it. You know, and they say, well, here I am, you know, nobody can hurt me now because I'm protected and guns don't protect you. And
exactly.
I'm glad to get that message out. Okay.
Yeah. So we were only because I know we have a short time and I'm long winded, but it was concerning that they didn't report it. And I felt he was invisible, you know, and then now he's traumatized. He would have never been in cuffs in his whole life. And he was on the phone with his sister walking home from a late football game let out. He was just with his Trigger buddies, and they told me. They had to tell me. So I was proud of, like, the connection that they made outside of our program, and now they're serving as each other's protective factors. But it was unfortunate that, you know, I'm having to continue to work for our youth through advocacy, versus all the time I love spending with our youth with development and enrichment and empowerment. I have to keep working for them because they don't have a voice.
I know.
He did not matter that night because he had parents to pick him up. You know, his parents aren't going to say anything because they're noble, but that's not right. And so when they introduced this pilot program, I was like, woo, the government has a program. It's a program, finally. And then they said curfew. I was disappointed.
Yeah.
I said, that's not a pilot program when I think of that. And so what I learned is that MPD doesn't know what happens to the youth after they arrest them or take them in. And then I know DYRS touched base with them, but they're short-staffed. So I'm concerned that if they do give these youth resources, what's really reaching them? And so that's another thing, is that there's really a lot of gaps in communications across agencies, agencies to community, community to agencies, and it's a mess. It's really the recipe, the manifestation of what we're seeing.
You know, I think you're taking just a great approach to fill in those gaps. You're working with all the right people. Like I said, I have a master's degree in American public policy. University of Michigan Survey Research Center when I was in school, I don't know what it is today, but at the time it was considered the greatest political think tank at a collegiate level. So you're dealing with all the right people, and I think you have to take a holistic approach. And that's what I see. I see the curfew. Then I see another council member who wants to call in the National Guard, which seems like really knee-jerk to me. I'm sorry, did you say who?
I said, no. I know who. Yeah. I was saying who out of disappointment and shock still. But really, we have our own dirty laundry in our city. I don't believe, because in the same breath, the mayor has honored my work. You know, it's not the mayor's fault. It's not the attorney general's fault. It's not the lack of prosecution fault. It is everybody a part of the solution, which is what has to be considered. And we are just stopping at the 270 individuals that have been deemed high risk in our city. Out of 800,000 people, we're focusing only on them. And you're still providing inadequate resources. And then you're not focusing on, if you think about like a ring, you have the nucleus, the middle, with the victims and the shooters. Then outside of that, you have witnesses. Then outside of that, you have survivors, which are the families, classmates, people that work with them, whoever survived their encounter with gun violence. And that's survivors of both sides of the gun, which we have to consider. Families that are broken apart due to incarceration, too, need support. So again, you got the shooters and victims in the middle. Then the next level, you have witnesses. Next level, you have survivors. Next level, you have people exposed. Or for the sake of trigger, we focus on youth exposed. And then the last level is general population. If all 800,000 of us stepped into this this membership club of being impacted by gun violence and said we want to do something, we could do it without the touch of anybody above our own local government and our communities. We have the solutions in the communities. We just need the support that needs to be us first. And we keep hearing more whole government approach. We keep hearing conflict resolution, but that is all after the fact. You know, what about developing them just to know how to speak? I didn't know how to introduce myself until a public speaking class at NC State. And I embarrassed myself. And now I can speak well, but I had to practice and I had to educate and I had to really break a lot of learned behaviors. And I still struggle with speaking sometimes because of where I've come from with that. But we really got to get to, again, what prevention is. And we define that prevention as the absence of disease and the proactive state of gun violence.
Well, that's so important. And yeah, let me say on behalf of elected officials, because I'm an elected official, that I get it, that they want to, you know, they want to do, there's a lot of pressure on them. We've got robberies up by 70%, homicides are up, violent crimes are up, carjackings are up. And, you know, the politicians want to respond some way that's visual and sometimes they don't always think about the best solutions. You do have to take a holistic approach. Let me say that I come from a family of three children, and my brother was president of a college and my sister was partner in a law firm, and I dropped out of high school because I missed 128 days when I was a junior. They never once sent me to a counselor. They just knew that my life was hard, and they kept on letting me back in, and they kept on enabling me. And until somebody actually intervened in my life and said, "You got to change," I didn't change. And they helped me change. They just didn't tell me to change.
Yeah, we got to hold hands. Right. We got to hold hands. We got to walk with everybody. I think violence interrupters sometimes have a caseload of like 12 to 20 people. And if these are high-risk individuals, that's really like 2,000 people on your caseload. And so we need more resources to what's in place, and we need more resources allocated to gun violence prevention. Not, you know, we have an office of prevention, but it's really the office of reduction. No office in this city can do anything for Trigger University. Because there's
we need to change that
for prevention, and that's I was going to open you to collaboration because we need advice in terms of policy. We try to stay away from policy level and stick, you know, in the roots, but we keep seeing the red tape and the bureaucracy impact us. You know, for instance, there was a family, one of our favorite youth ambassadors. We asked this young man not to pick up a gun, to pledge to prevention, even though where he lives is one of the hottest blocks in the city. And so he lost his brother innocently to gun violence September 27th of this year. He also knew the young man that I said that I lost the third of this year. which is on my mom's birthday, and that irony killed me. It killed me.
Yeah.
You know, it kills me. But he, we tried to get him, his family, a quick move, a quick, rapid, safe move, because the community is still suffering from acts of violence till this day. There's been at least 4 shootings around his neighborhood. Anyways, we're trying to get him moved out. We were told by a government agency that the grant for moving families ended on September 30th. And I was talking to them on October 2nd. And I said, well, he passed away on the 27th. Can't you do something?
Yeah.
And they said, we're waiting to hear from the grantors. And that was it. So where
let me end it here. I'm sorry, we're running out of time. But let me tell you that you have a new ally in the fight. I'd be happy to work with you. I'd be honored to do whatever I could do. No, bless you, you know, because I've been really concerned about this problem, but I'm a 70-year-old guy. You're a woman who played basketball, which I'm sure gives you a lot of street creds, because I grew up in the city, and I know the only real sport on the street, at least when I was a kid, was basketball. So I'm sure people respect that about you. And it's so important, or young people respect that about you. It's so important to have people like you involved. Thank you for taking a holistic approach. Obviously, we scratched the surface here, so you're going to have to come back at some time.
Oh, I am yours forever. And hopefully we can bring back a young person. But really, I just ask, you know, where is the accountability? Where is the shared responsibility for this inaction and this negligence? And I think if we address that just immediately, then we could see a lot of crime and gun violence and youth violence prevented.
Well, you're my new favorite person. And and that's a lot. And that's coming a lot from a guy that went to the University of Maryland to say that about a North Carolina State basketball player. Because, you know,
hey, Maryland was my second choice. If that means anything, I thought I was going there, but you guys just won the chip. So I had to go and try to do my own thing. Go Terps.
It was a big mistake on the Terps part. But thank you so much. We leave our guest with a song as we close out the show, and I couldn't think of a better tribute than Marvin Gaye, What's Going On. Thank you, Tia, for finding out what's going on, because we really need to know, and I hope to talk to you again soon. We'll see y'all next week, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Amen.
Marvin Gaye, a victim of gun violence, but we all
mentioned. Victim of gun violence. I didn't even think of that, but yes, he was. Yeah. Thank you, Tia.
Thank you. We are prevention.
Yeah. Thanks. Stay on for a second. Okay, Doug, anytime you're ready.
Hey, what's up now? Brother, what's up? This is a big party, man. Yeah, brother, like, stop right on.
Give the people their right to vote.